tattoo.
It's just making me nervous, that's all. You know what would be effective is if we could actually... Now, I wouldn't want to violate Charmkins in that way, but you could just have... Could I have you please just talk into the chicken? Just say a few words to my chicken.
That'd be fun. Don't choke it.
Gently, and watch out for the dewlap. Yeah. That's what you call this, right? With the little guy? Is that the... This is the comb.
Yeah.
This is the dewlap, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know
really
much about chicken.
Pretty much it. Are we recording?
Yeah, I guess so.
Hi, Mr. Schreiber. I can call you Caleb, right? Is that okay? Yeah. Well, this is the second time we've done this radio interview, because if you recall, I'm not sure if you do, I think we got exceedingly drunk the other night and recorded over the last one with our jams. Was that what happened? Or
Something like that.
Something like that. Okay.
And, I'm a little, it's classified.
Without going into the details. Correct. Correct.
What do you do here?
I am the maintenance test pilot for the utility helicopters attached to the first of the 17th CAV here at Talifar Air Base, a.k.a. Sykes FOB. And basically we, as the utility aircraft, provide all the ash and trash, beans and bullets, which is, slang for taking soldiers around the, circulating the airfield, making sure supplies get around. On one side of the coin, all the way to, NVG air assaults with special forces and what have you not. So we are the responsible UH-60 element in this area, which is in Mosul, Talifar, and areas north.
And,
you okay? You looking all weird and stuff?
There's a buzz.
How's that? Better? I actually plugged it in.
okay.
You want to redo that? Are you good?
No, no. I thought it was just every once in a while. I'll edit it out. So what? Before you joined the military, what did you do?
Yeah, I was a freelance hippie. I basically traveled around. I utilized a common 25-cent piece coin or whatever local currency that was available to me at the time. And what I like to do is basically pick two destinations through process of elimination, and then I would utilize the coin to make the ultimate decision. We'd flip the coin and claim one side or the other to associate the direction that we take.
I didn't realize it was a common thing you did.
Yeah, it was something I did common, maybe half a dozen times, to be honest, for the major decisions.
Heads or tails when you joined the military?
Definitely tails, because... Yeah. Actually, that's the way it worked out. I think I was in Banská Štiavnica, which is a small town in central Slovakia at the time, and I was basically hanging out and smoking dope and playing music with the natives and working on some fiction, living in an old little stone house up there. And flipped a coin to decide whether I was going to go to Mallorca and manage a hotel, because I had previous hotel management experience when I lived in Malawi, or go to San Francisco and get back there to see how all my friends were doing, since it had been probably about 3.5 years at that juncture. Well, we flipped the coin and ultimately went back to San Francisco, and what we discovered is once where there was a free-loving, pot-smoking, laid-back hippie culture had been replaced. Now, this is in the, around 97, 98, been replaced by crystal meth. That was the newest rage when I got there. And for anyone who hasn't seen, I guess that was like 97, 98. But for anyone who hasn't seen... from an outsider's perspective, what that can do to one's circles of friends. I can tell you, I was shocked. Now, I did have to try the drug myself, obviously, because otherwise, how could I be someone who can make a judgment, but luckily for me, I'm not an addictive personality, I'm just an experimentalist, but unfortunately for a good deal of my friends, it was the latest and greatest, and they really latched to it and took off. And, gosh, it was like a nightmare, all these wonderful artistic people now wrapped around the axle wrestling with this python, and my very good friend, who had, in conjunction with that habit, had developed a taste for chasing the dragon. And with that in mind, you know, I wanted to get him out of that element. So at the time I was traveling with Jane, my wife, you know, I had met her in South Africa and basically had her tagging along with me through Europe and stuff, and sent her to England because her visa ran out, and took my buddy and his convertible Camaro and drove him all the way back to the East Coast while he kicked his heroin habit, which was a lot of fun, I might add. And, yeah, you know, just seeing that, and also have been traveling at that point for 3.5 years out of the suitcase. I just decided, you know, gosh, I want something to push me beyond that. You know, I wanted to do something extreme. Now, you know, the pilot thing had always been brewing in the back of my head, and, you know, I did some research and realized me with a social security number that got me absolutely nothing, you know, no credit rating, anything, you know, I just, was not going to be able to swing it in the civilian world, you know. I wanted to develop, you know, get some sort of real skill besides what I had presently. And, you know, after the research shit, I realized the Army was definitely the most, you know, logistically feasible vehicle to pull that off. Oh, no. Well, first of all, the Army's the only force that'll take, you know, dregs like me. Because I hadn't completed college, I only had like 3 years of college at the time. To get into the Air Force, you know, you gotta be one of those kids who's pretty well, determined from the get-go. You know, they really, you know, want those guys that come out of school and go straight to college and, you know, are on the straight and narrow, you know. They know that they're gonna fail well, capitulate with everything, you know. So, you know, the characters seem to tend more towards the Army if they wanna fly. They're willing to take, you know, well, folks like me, you know, and turn them into pilots, you know, and give them control of million-dollar helicopters in a combat environment with folks like you riding in the back.
That's right.
Helpless, pretty much, you know.
Well, that's why I traveled the rubber chicken.
Well, yeah.
Through a lot of tight situations.
And, you know, Charmkins is definitely an inspiration for what we do, you know. It's nothing like a rubber chicken in the front of the aircraft that you're getting ready to travel in to help you feel at ease, you know. Let you know that there's professionals up front that are going to take care of your needs, who are sensitive to maybe a fear of flying that you might have. And they're not going to just goof off with a rubber chicken up there. The rubber chicken is basically a way to show you that we mean business, that we're serious, you know, about what we do. And, you know, it's been a pleasure to have Charmkins along with us these last 2 weeks to fly. I really think it's done a lot for morale up here in the northern Iraq area. Yeah.
Definitely. What's it like to be the eye in the sky flying around every day or every other day, you know, of this war? It's obviously the world's watching, but you're the eye right over it.
Well, you know, it's funny because the landscape seems to blur into, and, you know, from our perspective, Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, Yazidis. Yeah, how do we pronounce that?
Yazidis.
Forgive me if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. And Christians and whoever the heck, shirtists, whatever the heck's out there, they all look the same from the air. I can't tell the difference. I don't know who's who. I know that we fly over and some people are waving and other people are throwing rocks. And, you know, I speculate that it all stems from their own, you know, personal experiences. Did they personally benefit from the United States here? Did it personally affect them and their family? You know, did it personally, you know, was it detrimental for them and their family? You know, did they fall out of power, fall out of grace, or did they have a relative that, you know, was affected by it? So, it's just regular people in their daily lives and stuff going about, you know, and as we fly over from that perspective, you just don't know. And I wonder, my counterparts in the streets, you know, they see so many faces, you know, they too don't know which ones are friendly and which ones aren't. They don't know which ones are motivated to shoot you down and which ones are waving because they're happy to see you flying over. So, you know, it can be a little nerve-wracking. But at the same time, it's just
I'll strike that. I think I fucking started rambling. I don't know what I was going to say. Tell me, or you told me before, but for the people back in San Francisco, tell them about the story of the five soldiers wounded in the cabin.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a, in one way you could say it's sad, and one way you could say it's the symptom of being
college.
Just killed this sect. Why? this sect bombed this sect, and they sent a child with bombs into a schoolyard to kill all these children, and then, you know, the retaliation, and it's just, it's horrible. But, you know, when you hear that on a daily basis, you become desensitized. It's not sensational. It's not some kid, you know, at Virginia Tech who's walked into a school and opened up fire, because that's not something that we as Americans are used to dealing with. Plus, we as Americans, you know, have a value for life that just doesn't seem to have a similar value here with the folks, you know. Death to them is a reality that happens daily. And, you know, they deal with it in a different way. But, you know, there we were in the cafeteria, you know, and somebody comes in the front door and yells out that we've got five soldiers down. Well, naturally, we all assume that it's an American group of soldiers, so everybody's up and racing out of the cafeteria, and then somebody says, "No, it's just Iraqis." And everybody stops in their tracks and goes back to their table and passes the salt and continues the conversations where they left off. But now, people just the same, but, you know, it definitely carries a different weight. I think, you know, we're all fed up. It's almost an anger, you know. When we heard that one of our guys is down, it's like, Christ, you know, why should we be in the middle of their killing war, you know? Just assume, pull back in our borders and let them take care of it themselves, in my opinion, but...
Now, you mentioned earlier that you had seen worse things before you even got to the war. Tell me about the dead baby.
Yeah, I guess that's a bit extreme. We did mention that. Well, you know, it's just being a Westerner, you could say that traveling definitely was something that widened your perspective, right? Especially when you go into cultures that are, you know, vastly different from what you're accustomed to. And, yeah, I told you I'd seen some horrible things. I think I did describe to you the guy who died in the back of the helicopter in Afghanistan with his intestines falling out all over the floor, and that was perfectly ghastly. But, you know, I remember think I was even more traumatized years before I even got in the Army when I was walking the streets of Calcutta, you know, and it was pre-monsoon season, and there were several people who had simply died on the street, you know. And at one point, walking on the street, there was probably an infant, you know, 1 year old, something like that, stretched out face down, you know, dead and obviously lifeless. And people were going about their business and just simply stepping over the infant as if it was just a piece of debris, you know. And I guess, you know, unique to that culture was, you know, it's I guess that was the karmic circle at play. And I don't want to make any comment or speculate, you know, on how the people felt about it, but, and maybe it was where I was at, but, you know, from my perspective, it was quite a routine experience. And you know, it's funny how you deal with it. At the time, I was not emotionally moved, you know, it was just kind of a matter of fact, there it is. But then later on, I remember walking the streets, and I found a kitten, you know, obviously separated from its home, and it was you know, in bad straits, and it was wandering into a huge track circle. And I grabbed the thing up and I brought it back to the safety of like a little walled enclosure and put it down. And here I am, you know, typically Western, very much upset about this kitten. How futile was it, really, in the middle of Calcutta slums, you know? You know, but wasn't moved by the so much at the time by the child. I guess maybe I internalized it and then, you know, kind of broke down at that point, you know, realizing how futile it was, you know, with the animal. Yeah, but, you know, we as Westerners seem to put a lot more, you know, stock in, you know, the kitten or the pet, you know, a way we can relate to it almost better than we can each other as humans, you know, especially when we're different.
Yeah. So, covering the death of, you know, of other humans, what, I mean, looking at your own chance of death here, from what I've learned being with you, it sounds like malfunctions of the helicopter are really the thing that might kill you more than being shot down.
Oh man, I think I've just had a bad string of luck. For the last week was a bad example. Typically they run, you know, fairly well, and it's a great system, the UH-60 Blackhawk. Sikorsky, pretty clever guy, built in a lot of redundancies to the aircraft. And It's fairly survivable, but it's like anything else. It definitely has its Achilles heel. So, well, the issue is that, geez, I remember we thinking we were flying a lot in Afghanistan when I was there 2 years ago with the same unit. Well, we were here, and on the halfway mark, we'd already gone well over the amount of total hours that we flew there for years. So we're flying more than twice as much as we did in Afghanistan, and and for the most part, it's legitimate. A lot of times it's very frustrating for, the crews and the pilots and the, because it seems like maybe we get 60 to 70% effective. A lot of times we show up, we gotta launch, we gotta go, we launch ourselves, two aircraft, put ourselves in harm's way, blah blah blah. All the maintenance, all the money, fly to a location, and there's tumbleweeds. There's nobody there that we're supposed to pick up. Nothing. Or, we got a, hey, we're on our way home. Somebody calls and says, no, you got to divert to this place. It's 30 minutes away. We fly over there, and some dude walks out with one box of Jell-O. That's an exaggeration, but that's what it feels like, And we're like, oh, what the heck? Are we putting ourselves out in harm's way for, if we can't? But, in any large operation going on, you can expect a degree of misinformation, you can expect a degree of disorganization too, and that's just what we deal with. But the more hours we fly on the aircraft, the more likely it is to develop problems. And the news typically reports on the sensational stuff when the aircraft goes down and people get killed. But what you really don't hear about is, all the bullet holes that we patch up, from week to week, from all the attempts that people have tried, to all the times they've shot at us but haven't hit us. We're a difficult target to engage for the most part, and we try not to give them an opportunity to hit us to the best of our ability. And at the same time, yeah, you've got that other element with flying as much as we do, you're just bound to run into maintenance. It's just a matter of odds. So yeah, we've had a couple of close calls with maintenance.
Could you describe to the people back home what it was like when you had to make that emergency landing in the field?
Well, which one?
The one where your engine went out.
Yeah, oh well, we lost an engine. This is on the first couple months we were here, so it was still very hot out. And just as a quick description, the aircraft is affected by temperature, i.e. how much weight that it can lift. So it was a very hot day, the aircraft was heavy, and
Passengers?
luckily we had no passengers, but we had a lot of other miscellaneous equipment in the back that we were hauling. We were the second aircraft, so we picked up to follow our aircraft out of Merez right there near Mosul, where you've been in and out a couple times with us. And as we took off, we pulled to about 150 feet and began to accelerate forward. And this is inside an airspeed altitude zone where we don't have the capability to hover the aircraft if we were to lose an engine. And on this one particular occasion, that's exactly what happened. We had a fuel line that had been chafing, was not readily visible to the pilots and the crew during pre-flights and post-flights inspections. And apparently when it chafed to the point to where I made a demand of power, and it's a high pressure tube that actually ruptured, which effectively sprayed fuel all over my number one engine, and effectively the engine flamed out. So with only one engine available, the rotor slows down and the aircraft falls out of the sky. And luckily for us, and it was just a measure of luck, there was a place that we could land that was, kind of right off to my left and front. So I was able to limp the aircraft as it fell from the sky to that landing zone and put it down safely.
The neat thing that I thought was that since you're the maintenance pilot, you fixed them and they flew home, right?
Right. I'm the Walmart of pilots. I'm one-stop shopping. I can fly your aircraft, diagnose its ills, and fix it all in one go, and then take it up and fly it to make sure it is actually fixed. So most units typically keep one or two maintenance test pilots for every 20 or 30 some odd pilots they have on the line, and primarily our responsibility is to maintain the maintenance of the aircraft, to overview the maintenance that's being done by our enlisted and civilian contractors, and then of course to verify and on the other side diagnose problems with the aircraft. Yeah. Verify in the means of test flights to make sure that it was actually the correct component and we fixed it correctly.
So tell me now about the cool bus.
Oh, the cool bus.
Trying to make these comparisons between the cool bus and the Black Hawk.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny. I remember, years ago. I was the head pilot of my own hippie bus. You know, we had this old short bus, and we left it true school bus colors because that kept the police at bay. You know, they on first glance they just assume it was a school bus, but if they looked at it any closer, they would have noticed that the school had those few letters that had been yellowed out, so it actually read the cool bus, right? Because we reckoned we were pretty cool driving around in this thing. We'd gutted it out and, you know, kind of pimped it out a bit. So it was an efficient ride for a group of musicians and all their entourage. But this was my little pet project. And, you know, being the guy in the band who primarily drove and took care of the bus, you know, along with I considered myself the maintenance pilot for the bus as well, you know. This is, of course, in hindsight, you know, and I just draw the parallel of us road tripping because, you know, you commented when we were flying around on the bird the other day, it's a lot like just road tripping, yeah, you know, minus the beer, of course, you know. So, you know, there's a parallel, yeah, we'd drive on the bus, we'd tour, you know, with the band, and of course it was from location to location, you know, in long hours, you know, and when the dang thing broke down, I'd simply pull it over and fix it myself, you know, and then off we'd go again, you know. Back on the road making the trips, and that's the same sort of scenario if you noticed actually the other day you weren't with us when we had a hydraulic pump go out, and same deal, I landed it, fixed it, and off we went again. So yeah, the cycle continues just in a different venue.
Yeah. Usually when you break down, are the other pilots is hostile for wanting to fix the helicopter as they were when we were in Moraes and they were calling you a pussy?
Yeah, yeah, they were upset with me. We had that incident where I guess one of the fuel cells wouldn't close properly, so we had fuel leaking down the side of the aircraft. And you know, most of the pilots are eager to go out, fly, do their missions, and get back to the base here where they can go back to their chew, close out Iraq, you know, by shutting the door and escaping to whatever world they have waiting for them there, you know. And, you know, and especially, you know, with the extension, I think people's patience are definitely tried, you know. It's what a kick to the sack, you know. Thank you very much, Uncle Sam, because now what seemed like we were at almost the end was in sight, you know. The carrot's been dangled, dragged out further, you know, to the point to where it just, I don't even know where or when we're getting out of here, it feels like, you know. So, you know, this... definitely morale wasn't soaring prior to this, and now, you know, it's probably even lower. Not a probable, but is, you know. And, you know, so the guys tend to lose their patience quicker than we did before. And, but, you know, being the maintenance guy and the guy responsible for the aircraft, yeah, there we were, not someplace that we wanted to be, you know, in a secure environment, but, you know, no place we wanted to spend the night, definitely, if we could help it. And so they wanted me to cut some corners and figure out a way to just stop the fuel leak, which wasn't necessarily possible. And so, yeah, they resorted to name-calling. But with a name like Shirt, I'm fairly immune to that sort of harassment, you know. And ultimately, I had to do some quick thinking and a little bit in the field maintenance to make it actually work out for us, since we couldn't manage to get the actual part we needed. But in the long run, we all came home, and we came home safely. I think I told you at the time, it's like, especially with the extension, it's like every day we take off and we fly around and there's the possibility somebody's going to shoot you down. That's a given, you know? That's what they want to do. They want to shoot us down. Looks great on CNN, and it sells, you know? CNN loves that. But the thing is, it's like, for me, shit, I ain't taking any extra chances. You know, I happen to like my wife a great deal, and I have the mindset of getting back to her in one piece, so I'm not putting my neck out on the line for anything, you know, more than I have to.
So why go through all this 10 years of giving up your freedom? I mean, what are you going to get out of this?
Well, you know, everybody should come in with a goal. Some folks just come in with the idea of escaping their past life and what have you not. But, you know, for me, it was a clear focus goal with an end statement in mind. I wanted to buy my own boat, so I wanted to have my own sailboat. Obviously, I wanted to. I knew nothing about avionics, knew nothing about aircraft, knew nothing about its systems, you know. I should say, I knew nothing about aviation. And I wanted to, educate myself to the best of the ability. I wanted to learn the mechanic side because, you know, I was used to being independent in my bus, you know, when I traveled around the country, you know. And I wanted to be independent in the air as well. So I wanted to be able to fix my own aircraft and fly them. And, you know, the Army worked out excellent. It definitely helped me to fulfill those goals, you know. The war was an unfortunate sideline. It's not what we were, you know, coming in to do, you know, for myself. Right, right. As a matter of fact, I was in flight school at 9/11, and I thought, oh, man, you know, here we go. Now we're all along for the ride.
Yeah. Were you angry? Did you want to be like, I want to go over and blow some shit up, though?
What, at the 30 people responsible? No, not really. I mean, you know, what do you expect? We're the Rome of the modern world, you know. There's a lot of people who love us and a lot more who hate us, you know. So, because of the position we're in, you know. Shit, if it wasn't us, it'd be somebody else, you know. But we're a target and we always will be. And
so you have a plan, though, for you're not going to do your 20 years in the Army.
No, I'm definitely not retiring in the Army. It's funny because they were talking about, you know, trying to do a 10-year incentive, and I was watching that bait be dangled. I'm glad they're not doing the 10-year incentive because now there's no bait to dangle. You know, I'm pretty sure I wasn't going to capitulate even if they had that offer available for me. This is the end of my contract. When you go to flight school, you owe them 6 years upon completion. It's a contract. They want to get their money's worth. It's expensive to put you through school. Not only that, but if you look at it this way, you get paid through school, and then really they're giving you an opportunity to become an expert at your field. You know, by the end of the 6 years, you're marketable. You can actually go out and do something with the skills you've learned. In this case, be a pilot or be a maintenance pilot. But at the same time, you know, you got to make that decision. You know, a lot of people just plod on through the Army or, you know, without any kind of focused goal as to where they're going to go with it. But I had the master plan, and it was pretty much, like I said, buy my sailboat, finish my education, and get the heck out of Dodge. And that's worked out awesome for me. I got a 42-foot blue water ocean cutter in Hawaii, which is where I wanted to be and where I've been for the last 6 years, roughly. It's great. Love to surf, man. It's awesome. Love the sea, you know. Love my boat, and that's freedom. And, of course, I've also, done some investments while I was in. Also finished my education outside of the Army with in regards to aviation. I got all my fixed-wing ratings as well, and going to finish up my A&P license, which is an airframe and power plant. And then I'm going to go ahead and sell a couple condos that I've got. So the end goal is for me to, next year this time, I will be sailing to Fiji on my boat. And prior to that, I will get up and say goodbye to all my friends in the Army and utilize this money that I get from the two condos I sell to pay off all my debts completely. And I'm planning on buying a suitcase, an alligator skin variety with matching thong and bow tie, I think would be a nice touch. And fill that with about $150,000 of profit that I should be able to wing out of these property sales. Free and clean of society, and I don't think I'm going to come back to society after that. No more real jobs. That's pretty much it for me.
Excellent. Tell me about your Burning Man experience.
Oh, yeah, man, that was great. I just showed up in San Francisco, and great guy there is a computer programmer in the Bay Area said to me, hey, let's go ahead and do this Burning Man thing. At the time, I was like, I'm not too sure what you're talking about, but hey, I'm game, especially if it involves sex and drugs, you know, music. That's a no-brainer. So we hopped in he had a converted mail Jeep, and we drove that to some place in the middle of nowhere in Nevada, and got jiggy with the local inhabitants. Now, this is Burning Man Extreme. This is before it went all corporate and stuff. This is back when there people could have sex in great big groups right there out in the middle of the playa, and everyone dealt with it like it was a normal everyday experience, you know. And that was a lot of fun, that one. I regret to hear that it's quite a sponsored event nowadays. Yeah, it's.
I remember when I was just getting to know your email, you said, do you think the Burning Man community can handle the truth about the war? What is that truth as you know it?
Ah, geez, that's a hell of a question, man. Would you write that down and read that?
I just remember you had emailed it to me. Do you think they can, you know?
Well, I guess what I was referring to, and I had a old hippie friend, he's driving a taxi cab, I guess, there in San Fran. Took my wife and was driving her, you know, back home, and she asked him, oh, so you used to know Shirt? And he's like, well, I know Shirt, but now I don't know a single cell in his body, you know. And the way she took that and the way that she seemed to relay to me the rest of the conversation was to say that he had alienated himself to me since I had made this decision to come over, you know, and cut my hair and join the army and, you know, go to the other side, so to speak, you know. And I say, you know, that's funny, because, what was he doing? He's driving a cab. So essentially, you know, he's not on a rickshaw. He's not burning biodiesel. He's not doing anything that's going to help to, you know, put us in a situation where Americans aren't dependent on what we're doing over here. Because let's face it, the reason we're here is for the oil. We're here because we want to perpetuate a lifestyle that we've become accustomed to. Americans want to be able to get into their SUV and drive two blocks down to the 7-Eleven to get a gallon of milk and a bar, Snickers bar, or something like that, right? You know, we don't want to give up anything. We've got it. We've got it good. We take it mostly for granted, and we don't want to give one ounce of it. And if that means that a bunch of Americans got to come over to Iraq and stuff like that, that doesn't really mean anything to anyone, unless, of course, it's your son or daughter that's over here that doesn't come back, you know. But without that personal connection, you know, and, you know, I'm sure veterans of other wars and people who have been in that situation probably can relate and maybe feel a similar sort of despair on the futility of it. You know, if Americans could even just adjust their lifestyle even marginally, you know, if we could carpool, if we could depend more on alternate sources, if we made a real effort, you know, to adjust our lifestyles, then maybe this wouldn't be necessary. But, you know, for all those guys who are George Bush beaters, you know, love him or hate him, he's a public service. He's a public servant, and he's basically doing what the public wants. He's perpetuating the American lifestyle through excess decadence and consumption.
Okay.
Boy, you're gonna really have to edit that.
Yeah.
That's
what it
Do you think you could sound forge this to make me sound a lot better? And like,
James Earl Jones.
Can you lower my voice a few octaves?
Yeah.
I couldn't really tell you my name, but suffice to say, I am a government employee. the rumors thing. That you've heard about the mountain of...
tell me about Eve.
Oh, Eve Online, it's my favorite escape right now. It's a MMO, I guess you call it, a massive online, or whatever the hell. MMO, look it up, Eve Online, it's great.
Being around you, it sounds like that's your one sort of sanctuary.
Right, because, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, we're not allowed to drink, we're not allowed to frolic with members of the opposite sex, we are not allowed to look at pornography, we are not allowed to, I'm sure it's somewhere, masturbate. We can't even look at our own genitalia regions. We're required to shut our eyes in the shower and clean it that way. And so, you know, here we are, soldiers, you know, living in that monastic environment where we have leaders with unreasonable expectations, you know, and unreasonable demands, you know, and meanwhile we're trying to keep our morale up, which they pay lip service to quite a good deal of. So everybody's found a way to escape. You know, I read a lot of cheesy sci-fi. Thank God I've got my music, you know, and then I've got EVE Online, and I'm an addict. I play as much as I possibly can, because when I enter that world, I'm not in Iraq. Talafar, let's see, it's right on the edge of the airfield's 5 nautical mile ring, so we're talking pretty close. Well, I think, as you probably well know, you know, it was slated to be the model city, you know, communities of the different religious sects intermingling successfully in an environment where there was no violence. Yeah, right. How long did that last? You know, and that's what kills me. You know how many wars have we had against people who are just different from us? Culture's different. They look different. You know what I mean? This is like the Protestants and the Catholics or something. Here we go. The Sunnis and the Shiites. Oh, come on, don't you guys both, work, you know, aren't you both all about, you know, Muhammad? You know, and you know, I'm pretty sure, although I'm definitely not the most educated person on the matter, that almost all these religions have a fundamental axiom based upon, you know, treating other human beings decently. You know, I thought that's why we embraced religion, was to learn to be better people. How does anyone who claims to be a better person or in line with God, how can they assume to know God's will to such the degree that they can be motivated and justified to send a bus full of explosives into a marketplace to kill 100 people, mostly children and women, you know? I guess here they view children and women just like, you know, combatants, you know? For us from the West, you know, we kind of shy away from killing children and women, curiously enough, but... that's our perspective. So whether which one's right or which one's wrong is dependent on what side of the globe you were raised on, I imagine.
Could you describe that explosion?
Yeah, that was I was outside, I guess, I don't know if I recall, it was in the afternoon, I believe, and basically pretty darn close. Geez, you know, you can probably get the exact tonnage of the explosive they used, but let's just say a really freaking big explosion. Complete with shaking everything in the fob, you know, and huge mushroom cloud. And then something like, what was it, 15, 20 minutes later, the second explosion ripped through the marketplace. And then once that's going, it's like the party's on. Next morning we wake up to find out that the police from the opposing sect simply went out and massacred 100-some people. You know, let's just get it on. Let's get all hell breaks loose in the city that was the model for the rest of Iraq, you know. Now, how do they put their families back together now after that? They don't. How long do you think that's going to go on for? You think we're going to fix that in, what, 10 years that we're going to end up being here or more? Do you think we're ever going to fix the fractions between these societies? I mean, they're still pissed off about stuff that happened 600 years ago. You think they're going to get over their kid? Their child that was just blown up in the marketplace last week.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you want to add? How about your sheep? Tell me about your sheep.
The sheep was a godsend. Thank you very much to Jane, my lovely wife. She knew right where to go to bring my heart back in alignment with all the nonsense that goes on here, and she's sent me a lovely little sheep that actually, and I wish I had it here with me to illustrate, but I think you've got the sound bite, so you could probably help me out there. If for anyone who's been flying around Iraq in the last few weeks, they might have noticed on the common traffic advisory frequencies that aircraft talk to each other to give out locations of, you know, just in a general sense, we obviously don't like to compromise our position to anyone who may be listening online. So for the other aircraft in the northern Iraq area, and for the insurgents who are probably listening to the radios with the intent of shooting us down, they've heard some curious noises, and basically that's my mechanical sheep as it bays across the airwaves there. So.
Anything else you want
to
add?
Nah, man.
All right. Yeah, we're 40 minutes. So. Excellent.